G'day, this is Stuart Emery, and you're listening to David Wood on the Kick-Ass Life Show.
Make your life better?
This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Hey, good morning and welcome to the show. Boy, do I have a show for you today. Just an amazing, amazing guest. Somebody I got to share the stage with this last year and at an e-woman conference in Dallas. And it was amazing to watch this craftsman at work. Somebody whose experience is etched into every single word, and his wisdom is humbly delivered in a very, very kind, funny, and effective way. But when we did our show, this guy lives just outside of Vegas, a couple of hours outside of Vegas, in Gunlock, Utah, and actually collects guns, has a shooting range on his property, has a huge, huge, huge ranch with cattle and horses. And so I thought, as a tribute to him, I don't know if this is his kind of music he listens to, but I'm guessing. And I'll tell you a story right afterwards. So here we go.
Asking for a miracle, hoping she's not arrived. Praying it's the weather that has kept him out all night. And the thunder rolls. And the thunder rolls. The thunder rolls. And the lightning strikes. Another love grows cold on a sleepless night. As the storm goes on out of control, deep in her heart, the thunder rolls.
Yeah, you know what? I was never a country fan until I bought a country and western saloon. we bought a property with a country bar, and we called it a fun dining restaurant. And but in a town of 8,000 people called High River, Alberta, and real cowboys came in all the time, and you could tell the real cowboys because they work with cattle, and you could normally smell them before they got in there. But oh my gosh, salt of the earth, and just great people. And I was fortunate to get to ride with a group of cowboys for a day, and we got into a little trouble here and there, but riding through town on horseback with a group of hardened and fun and free-living cowboys was just the highlight as we galloped down Main Street and jumped the fence by the 7-Eleven and ran off into the massive, massive fields in the shadow of the Rocky Mountains. And that part of Alberta in Canada, the Rockies are, on a clear day, they feel like you can just reach out and grab them. And the sort of the gnarled look and the very heart of what a cowboy is, I got to experience this day. I couldn't walk for a week afterwards because I'm not used to riding horses for like 9-10 hours. One of the guys gave me a silver money clip, which I still have today, which was a gift from his dad. And he said to me, you know what, just because apparently, we had this real bond that day. How the day started, we did a sort of a photo shoot. And so we allowed them to bring their horses in the saloon. And we sort of gave them a few beers and made them lunch. And we did these photographs with me and my partner, Emil, on horseback. And then they said, hey, do you want to come out for the day? And I thought, you know what? Absolutely. But I felt like that old time, when people were on horseback and they go wherever they wanted and do whatever they wanted. So we had this just remarkable day. It's still etched in my memory. And when I was talking to my guest, and over his shoulder were his part of his gun collection. I find him to be this wonderful paradox of personal and professional range. in everything about him, from his faith to his collections, to the way he lives his life, to his family, to his work, and his passion from the stage. Just a wonderful, wonderful man with a great heart, and brilliant at what he does. So why don't you sit back, relax, and enjoy the wonderful Hiram W. Smith. So as I'm sitting here overlooking the wonderful Lake Okanagan, I have this well of excitement that's inside my tummy right now, because I have just an amazing guest here. And we shared the stage recently at an amazing conference, the eWomen Network conference, and watching someone who is so good at what they do and able to impart information in the way this gentleman does is truly remarkable. It has an incredible gift. So Hiram, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, welcome to the show.
You're very kind.
That's going to cost you $20.
I was going to say, I'm going to take you with me. You can introduce me.
So, Hiram, you know, you're in Gunlock, right?
Gunlock, Utah. I'm in the southwestern corner of Utah. I'm exactly a two-hour drive from Las Vegas.
Yeah, and you live on a 2,000-acre ranch, sort of with a cattle ranch. And,
that's correct.
You know, I said to you a second ago, there's this sense of pioneer spirit that oozes out of every part of you. Is there this deep affinity to sort of that sort of pioneering kind of mentality?
Yeah, there really is. My ancestors came across the plains in 1847. By wagon train. They came out here to Utah, and they colonized Utah. And so my great grandfather walked across the plains when he was 12 years old, helping his mother. My great great grandfather had passed away, and the pioneer thing's a big deal. In fact, I'll tell you a neat story. In 1997, the state of Utah reenacted the Pioneer Trek from 1847, and 35 wagons, about 300 people, horses, and we joined the wagon train for 10 days, and it was an amazing experience. You know, I've been teaching time management for years and years and years, and it changed my whole perspective of time. Because, our first day with the wagon train, We traveled from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. and we went 11 miles. And I thought, oh my gosh.
Well, that begs the question, how long did the original pioneers take to cross that country?
3 months.
Wow.
3 months. And that reenactment, they did the exact same 3 months. It took them 3 months. We only joined it for 10 days. But we were on horseback, so we didn't walk. We took some horses up, and we were riding horses. But I'll tell you, on the 1st of July, we got up at 4 in the morning to get the wagon train ready to go. We were at the Continental Divide in Wyoming, and it was 23 degrees. All the ice water was frozen, the buckets were covered with ice. And I'm thinking, man, we had Gore-Tex jackets. Those pioneers didn't have anything, I don't know how they did it, I swear.
Well, the other thing is, I was thinking about those ones that were on the actual wagons. I mean, there's no suspension, and they're going across rough terrain. I mean, on horseback, day after day after day, your body takes a pounding. But, I mean, it must be so different to be stuck on the back of a wagon, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You call your program kick-ass, they were hard-ass people.
Rough ass. Well, yeah, talking about that, this idea of, you say you've been teaching time management for a long time. I mean, you've really brought the teaching of time management into a whole other realm, it feels like. And do you want to talk a little bit about, the specialty? I know you have a lot of specialties, but if we stay in this one for a moment here, how does someone become an expert in time management?
Well, it's interesting. What started me on my road to creating the Franklin Planner and the Franklin Covey Company was a passion to teach. I had a career in the computer industry with a company called ADP out of New York, and I discovered that what I really wanted to do is teach, and I looked at the academic world, and I didn't have the credentials to teach there, so I decided, well, I'll teach in the corporate world. They'll take anybody in the corporate world. And, and in 1983, when we started, you know, there was a recession going on, and so people, you know, people were getting laid off, and so productivity of the people who were not getting laid off became a very important thing. And, you know, I felt like, you know, I had a concept, I had grown up living a concept that I could teach to other people and have it work. And the way you become an expert at time management is to realize that time has nothing to do with the clock, or time management has nothing to do with the clock. And so we, you know, we define early in the learning experience, we would define time. You know, I've taught, I don't know, thousands of seminars, and I always pick somebody out when I start and I say, define time for me. And I get this deer in the headlights stare, you know, and they say, well, time is money, you know, and time is the clock. And I and so I take them back to Einstein's definition. Einstein said that time is the occurrence of events in sequence, one after the other. And if you think about that, and then you get a definition for management, according to the dictionary, management is the art or act of controlling. So if you put those two together, what is time management? It's the art or act of controlling events. So the next question that you have to ask, well, what are the events over which I have any control? And, you know, we would teach a simple control model. I'd set a room up, you know, the left side of the room would be no control. The right side of the room would be absolute total control. And then everything in between. And I'd go to the left wall, you know, give me examples of stuff you have no control over. And, you know, I'd say, well, the weather and stuff. And some people would say death. And I'd say, who's death? That always gets a laugh, you know, but. But, you know, the issue is, you know, what do you do with events you have no control over? You have to adapt. I mean, is there any sense in getting upset over an event over which you have no control? No.
The truth is, Hiram, a lot of people do get upset about the events.
Absolutely.
I mean, and that's...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They do. And so one of the issues is to teach yourself, when you're up against an event you can't control, to adapt rather than complain. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So then we move over to the other side. Well, you know, what are the events over which you have absolute, total, and complete control? And, you know, when I asked that, I said, give me examples of events you have total control over. And everybody starts looking at their shoes, you know, and they say, I don't control nothing. You know? And I said, come on. You know, I control what I eat, what I wear, what time I get up in the morning. And, you know, what do I have total control over? I have control over me. You know, that's the only thing I have total control over. How I react to somebody else's attitude, what I say, how I feel. That's the only thing. So then everything else in between the no control and total control are events over which I only have partial control. And so the issue is to find out and to measure, well, exactly how much control do I have over that event? It may be a meeting at the company. It may be a telephone call. You know, for example, when your phone ringing is an urgency. Do I have to pick it up? No. But I always do, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I tell people, you want to feel real sense of power, next time your phone rings, let it ring.
Well, it was funny when you said that, because what went through my mind was this idea when now, you know, people have these alarms when a text comes in and, you know, they're having dinner or anything like that. They say ding, and suddenly you see the whole physiology of that person change, that they have to run over. Because, I mean, it feels like today, if you don't get back to someone in 30 seconds, somehow you're being rude or something. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's, see, our culture, we've drifted that way as a culture, but that's something that people can control. You know, I heard last week that the measure of a really good speaker is someone who can keep people from going to their BlackBerries more than three times.
Hmm.
You know, and
that's why I confiscate them.
Yeah, me too. I'm militant, man. I tell you, somebody whips out an iPhone and I get ugly, but.
Ugly.
Ugly. That's when I start kicking ass, when people get their iPhones out.
So anyway, it's been a
fun thing to teach, because it's a real aha for people to realize that the only thing a clock tells me is how much time it takes the sun to go across the sky. That's an event I have no control over.
That's so great. You know, again, I don't want to sort of interrupt, because I see you're on flow here, but these sort of 10 natural laws of successful time and life management, I just want to sort of give context to people listening, is that, you know, as we explore this, this is going to be so relative to whether you're in a corporate boardroom or whether you're in a bedroom or whether you're in a kitchen, right? I mean, this is a philosophy of life. It's not time management, because people always mix that up, say, well, time management's about business. Time management's about living, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I've had a lot of people come up to me after a seminar and say, you know, Hiram, you're not teaching time management. You're teaching life management. Why don't you admit it? and my response to that is, you know what? We are teaching life management, but if we advertise that what we're doing is time management or life management, nobody'd buy it.
Yeah. I had this conversation because I just finished a tour of Australia, and we were in Thailand, Australia last month. And so I just got back, and we were having this conversation the other night, and it's so crazy, because so much of what I do is really about authenticity and about true connection to human beings. And yet, you know, I was saying how often I have to lure people in a room with money just so that we can have a real conversation about what really matters, so that they can become the person they need to become to get the money they want. But the money is like putting bait on a hook. But I mean, if I called it something fluffy, I'd be sitting there with three people, you know, singing Kumbaya. Yeah.
That's exactly right. So our Trojan horse is time management.
Awesome.
And they let us in because we're going to help them improve their productivity. And we do, in fact. Their productivity dramatically changes, but it changes for a very different reason than they anticipated. And so, you know, once we've got the foundation of what time is, it's really about events and trying to decide what the events you have control over. We then teach a really interesting concept that, you know, I call it now identifying your core. Before you can ever be really productive, you've got to get down into your core. You know, everything has a core. The earth has a core. Apples have a core. The human being has a core. And there's a little company, I'm working with right now called My Core. And the idea is, first, you find out what matters most to you. What's at your core? What are your governing values? And, you know, write those down and then write a paragraph describing what those values mean to you. For example, I may value being physically fit. That's not a goal yet. I just happen to value being okay physically. Okay. Well, if I value being physically fit, step two, and this is where we get into the natural law thing. Step two is, I've got to identify the long-range goals that will help me become physically fit. That makes sense?
Yep.
Then I've got to, step three, break down the long-range goals into intermediate goals, the little pieces. And then step four, what am I going to put in my daily task list today that comes out of my constitution? So if my task list today is exercise for 35 minutes, that is relating back to one of my governing values, one of the highest priorities in my life. You see, most people live in what I call the reactive as opposed to the proactive world. They're reacting to their iPhones and iPods and iPads, and they're reacting to their boss, and they're reacting to the telephone, and they're doing everything everybody else thinks they ought to do when they ought to do it, and they're frustrated as hell, and they can't understand why they're unhappy on Friday night. And the reason for that, in my opinion, is they haven't done anything that week about what matters most to them, okay? And so the minute I write that, you know, when we talk to people about writing that personal constitution, it really gets under people's skin. And I use Ben Franklin as my, you know, I named my company after Ben Franklin. He's kind of my mentor. And when he was 27 years old, he sat down and identified what mattered most to him. He came up with 12 governing values. He called them his 12 virtues, and the friend said, suggested he had needed to add one. He needed to add humility. So he added a 13th, and the 13th was humility. One of them was temperance, and he wrote paragraphs describing what these values meant. And then he organized his life into 13-week cycles, and for one week out of 13, Ben Franklin would focus on one of those values in an effort to bring what he did in line with his values, you know. And Ben Franklin, in my opinion, was probably one of the most productive Americans in our history, if not the most productive. And the reason for that is because he started at his core. And so we use that story, you know, in teaching our seminars. You know, once you have written your own personal constitution, I mean, that's what, you know, Franklin participated in creating the Constitution for the United States. And what did they do when they sat in that meeting? They sat in that meeting in Philadelphia in 1787, and they said, you know, what matters most to us? That's the title of one of my books, What Matters Most. And they said, well, the freedom of speech matters, the freedom of religion matters, and all this stuff. And so they wrote paragraphs describing what that meant, and that became the Constitution of the United States. And no law today is ever ratified in the United States of America unless it's measured against the Constitution for consistency. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, absolutely.
So what we say to the human being is, write your own Constitution. You know, if I've got 16 elements to my Constitution, you know, and let me just tell you a quick, really neat, very powerful story that I've used a long time that helped people understand how powerful this is. And what I'll do in a seminar is I'll ask somebody, now I'm going to help you identify what your governing values are, and I need somebody in the room to help me that has a child under the age of 2. And I like to pick a guy if possible, but there's usually a guy. So, and it's a younger guy, and I'll say, okay, what's the child's name? And the guy's name, my name's David. Okay, what's the child's name? Well, it's Sabrina. Okay. All right, here's the situation, David. I have on the street out in front of this hotel an I-beam that is 300 feet long. You know what an I-beam is? Yeah, everybody knows what an I-beam is. Okay. Right. I'm going to put you at one end of the I-beam. I'm at the other end. I'm going to take a $100 bill out, and I'm going to say, if you'll come across this I-beam, get here in 2 minutes without stepping off either side, I'll give you $100. Would you come? Well, of course. It's on the ground, right? Yeah, it's on the ground. I'd come. All right. Now I'm going to change the scenario. I'm going to take the same I-beam, put it on the back of a long flatbed truck. This is some truck. And we're going to go to the north rim of the Grand Canyon. There's a place there that's 300 feet wide, 1,100 feet down. We're going to bolt this I-beam into both walls. You're on one side, I'm on the other side. I hold up my $100. Dave, if you'll come across this I-beam without stepping off either side, get here in 2 minutes, I'll give you $100. Would you come? No way. All right, now I have $10,000. Would you come for $10,000? No way. $50,000? No. All right, now I have $1,000,000. Now it's raining and the wind's up a little, but I've got $1,000,000 on my side. Would you risk that I-beam for a no way? All right, I'm going to change the scenario one more time. I'm not a nice guy anymore. I have Sabrina by the hair over the edge on my side, and I say, David, if you don't get across that I-beam right now, I'm going to drop your daughter. Would you come now? Damn right I'd come now. Okay.
Yeah, kick your ass.
I'll kick your ass when I get there. And I say, you know, we've just discovered one of your governing values. And that value is I love my child. Now, money has value. Safety has value. But of a greater value is the love of that child. You would probably risk the I-beam for that child. That is what governing values are all about. And then I tell them, you know, I did this once with a woman that had a teenager, and they will not come across for a teenager.
They'll pay you $1,000,000 to drop it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it happened to a true story. I was in San Diego once, and she said, drop him.
Let me just ask a quick question, just so I can get clarity for a bit. So with these values, are you finding across the board, you've trained tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people in this arena. Do you find the values are pretty consistent around the board, or do you find there's a great variety in different cultures? Or, I mean, what are you seeing with the value piece?
Well, it's interesting. Those people that have shared them with me, and hundreds of them have, there's really an interesting consistency of three or four. For example, generally, there's a value that has something to do with their physical well-being. Generally, there's a value that has something to do with integrity or honesty. Are you with me?
Right.
Generally, there's a value that has something to do with my family and taking care of my family. Generally, there's a value of being okay financially. Okay, those are very. It's rare that those aren't in the mix. And then there, you know, and some people will have seven or eight governing values. Some have 12. You know, the number isn't important. What's important is that they matter to you. And so then I have people write the question: what would you cross the I-beam for? And I got to tell you, that gets under people's skin. And then I got to tell them, I said, you know, I've got 16 governing values, and would I cross that I-beam for all 16? I don't think so, you know. But, you know, the first three, I think I would. and so that's it. Then they want, well, crap, what's the first three, you know? And, you know, for me, you know, one, you know, the two of the first three have something to do with my relationship with God, you know. And I'll share that with people if they want to hear about it, because some people don't want to know that. But
well, actually, you know, I want to let me touch on that, because something I feel about you, which I find really, really beautiful. Lots of things I feel about you is beautiful, but this idea that you obviously are have deep, deep, deep faith, and you and I don't know each other very well. I'd like to change that. And you have this deep faith, yet your presence, even every part of you, has this beautiful range of possibility. Is that your faith isn't? It's all around you, but it's there in such a beautifully accepting and casual and wonderful and rangeful manner that it's almost palatable. I don't know if I'm I know I'm not making sense here, but I hope you're getting what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I am getting, you know, what you're saying.
And it's not sort of put in a small box here. It's almost like it's all encompassing, and it's that belief system that you carry in your heart. And I see it in the picture on your Skype, you know, surrounded by your children, your grandchildren, possibly great grandchildren there. But this faith is, it seems like the tapestry that's woven into every aspect of you, yet there's this kind of down-to-earth, swashbuckling kind of, you know, pioneer, and there doesn't seem to be any limitation on where some people put, and again, I'm not trying to get into a faith conversation, but you know how some people wear it in a small box?
Oh,
it
absolutely.
Just seems that you have it kind of everywhere, and it's so sexy and refreshing, if I can say that. Sexy is a great word, right?
Yeah, that's a great word. I've never had my faith be referred to as sexy. That's kind of I have to tell my wife that.
Honey,
so, you know, the fact is, you know, what I basically, you know, if you have a basic core belief, and as I look at my, you know, my governing values, my core beliefs, that we're here for a reason, and that we're here to help other people's lives, make other people's lives better, and that there is a higher power. And, you know, people can define what that power is for themselves, but, you know, I happen to believe that there is a God, and that God wants me to do something that matters here. And if that's kind of the underpinnings of what you're about, then your ego doesn't get in the way. You know, Ken Blanchard is a good friend of mine. He wrote a foreword to one of my books, and we've spoken together all over the world. He did the One Minute Manager book, you know. He was here a couple weeks ago. And he says, you know what ego stands for? And I said, no. He says, edge God out.
Mm.
And that's pretty cool. So it's not it's in the background, but it kind of it has a major impact on how I look at the world, you know. And, you know, that's why we do what we do. I mean, you know, we get paid well for what we do, but that's not, you and I don't do what we do for the money. Because if we did it for the money, we'd be out of business in about 2 years.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
People would know that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And people can tell when your motive is strictly to take their money away from them. But if they really know and believe, and in our case, I believe it's true that we're there because helping their life become better really matters to us, then they open up and they're willing to internalize the concepts that we share with them. And knowing, we know that if people will just experiment with the concepts that we share with them, that their lives are going to be better. I guess the highlight, one of the highlights of my whole career was a guy at 34,000 people at Dow Chemical all over the world over an 8-year period. And a senior, like the three or four guy at Dow Chemical, when he retired, in his retirement speech, he said, you know, the most significant thing that happened to me in my 30 years at Dow Chemical was Hiram Smith's seminar on time management. You know, I thought, holy cow. I mean, that's like, I can die now. You know, I've succeeded, you know.
But that's, I mean, and that comes from that well. And I totally resonate with what you're saying. And you were sort of talking about your two values. The first two values are around your faith, around God. And again, I sort of steered you away from that. So I just want to make sure you're sort of, I'll pull you back to that place there. But it really is, I think, that connection with an audience, whether it's through this medium, and you know I work on stage the same way. Right, I do a lot of keynotes. But I think that intention of why we venture up there is palatable to an audience. And that deep shift that can occur, I think only occurs when you say that ego isn't part of what, you know, I mean, obviously you need to have an ego to get up there, but it's not that money is not a driving force. I don't know anyone. No. And those that who I do know had that driving force, here's what I really find interesting. Even if they sort of get away with it for a long period of time, what I notice is that they're sincerely unhappy at the end. There is no happy point that they get to in that fulfillment of their work, because the drive is just, the focus is one thing, right? That money thing, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I'll tell you a neat story. At one point, we started the company in 1983, and it exploded, and we took it public in 92, and we were training 60,000 people a month in live seminars. I had 150 presenters, and they were fabulous presenters. And one of my presenters, who was as good on his feet in front of a crowd as anybody I have ever seen, he came into my office one day after he taught about 150 seminars, and it had been a couple of years, and he walked in and he said, Hiram, I can't do this anymore. I said, what do you mean you can't do it anymore? He says, I just the thought of, you know, getting up in front of another crowd just makes me nauseous. I don't think I can do this anymore. And he looks at me and he says, how many times have you taught the seminar? At that point, I'd been about 1,800. And I said, it's close to 2,000 times. And he says, how do you do that? And so I asked him a question. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, when you get up in front of a seminar, do you count the number of people in the room and then multiply it by your commission factor? He says, how do you know I do that? And I said, that's why you're there. I said, if you don't love the people that are in that room, you're in the wrong business. You got to go drive a truck. I said, there's no way you're going to be able to do this 2,000 times, because you're doing it for the wrong reason. And it blew the guy away. He never thought about it, and the people can tell. I will tell you that I really believe that people in the audience can tell whether or not you care about them. Don't you believe that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And boy, the minute they know you're for real and that you're there because you love them, and I say, I use the word love because that's the word. That's the operative word. If you love the people that you're talking to, man, they believe what you tell them and they'll go try it.
And to sort of look at that, I mean, some people listening right now, when they hear that word, it's like the word God you used, if you use the word love, so many connotations come up for people and some people will discount it as, oh, that sounds so woo-woo or whatever, but only if you... I mean, in standing in front of a room, and I mean, I do seminars that are 7 days long sometimes, and there's a purity in that presence and a connection I feel with the audience, which it really is. There is no other word that could describe that feeling and that connection.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And because there isn't anything the expectation is not inside of me that to want something more for that person than they want for themselves, right? So it's really accepting them as who they are, how they are, and where they are in their life, and allowing them to take their own next step. But it's like an unconditional love, right?
Absolutely. Because, what runs through my mind, you think about it, I've spoken to audiences of 4 and 5 people, and I've spoken to audiences of 15,000. It's a very different experience, by the way. But no matter how many people are there, you think about whatever the people who have brought you there are paying to do it. And then the cost of bringing all the people there, the hotels, the meals, the investment that company, or even if it's a public seminar and they're paying $400 a piece to be at that seminar and you got 200 people there, I mean, do the math. I mean, those people are paying me and you a lot of money to do what we do. And so we've got to be good every single time. And the only way you're going to, I call it the fast gun syndrome. You know, the old gunslinger in the West had to be fast every time or he died, you know. Mm-hmm. And we've got to be fast every single time because that's their first time. That's their very first time. And so, you know, I just...
Well, you know, what's interesting, though, watching you on stage is that it still feels like it's your first time. And that's that freshness. And that again, is that passion and that deep purpose that allows you to stand up there after your 2,000th seminar. And yeah, the people in the audience whose first time it is looks at you and feels the freshness of a first-time presenter who's still as connected to the work because of its purpose and the reason behind it and the value... I mean, if you go back to, you know, our conversation on, you know, two of your primary core values, and you're saying that your faith and why you're here, knowing you're here for a purpose, and knowing each day when you get up, when you step into that purpose, that's where that freshness and that's why you have that beautiful energy around you all the time, right? Because it's like you still feel like it's the first day. Everything's curious. There's this fascination. There's this deep desire. And again, I'm not trying to make stuff up. It's just what I feel when I watch you, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I got to tell you a neat experience I had when I got through speaking there in Dallas. I don't know if you remember, but the woman that spoke before me was an African-American woman by the name of Linda Clemens. And she was very good. And she was a former CIA agent. She'd been trained to read body language. And she gave a fabulous presentation. But anyway, when I got through speaking, I spoke right after her. And as I came backstage after I got through talking, she ran up and threw her arms around me and gave me a big hug. And she said, "You and I are from the same mother." And I said, "You know, I believe that." And she said, "You are my brother." And we just had the neatest moment, you know, of connecting because we both felt that. You know what I'm saying? We both felt that emotional connection that only comes when you, A, believe what you're doing is right and that you love the people that you're doing it for. I mean, you've probably got more than I do, but I've got 6 million miles on commercial aircraft. I've spoken over 5,000 times in the last 35 years. And you know what? Every time I get up, a surge of energy comes through me that just is mind-boggling.
Mm. And I suppose the relatability to people listening in, as we talk about this profession, is finding that in whatever you're doing, whether it's raising a child or whether it's, you know, you have a job or a job, that in some ways, even if it's not the most fulfilling job, if you approach it one way, but when you can approach, I'll give you an example. This happened to me recently. I was in a bathroom in New York. And there was, you know, you have a bathroom attendant. Uh-huh. And this bathroom attendant was the most present, happy. There's a guy there who you think this must be a terrible job, right? Stuck in a bathroom all day long. But I still remember this guy. I remember the features in his face. I remember how I felt when he came. But he was just, this was something he did and he loved to do it. There was no question in my mind that this guy loved to do what he did. And because of that, there was this rich connection, but there was a man who I don't believe there was anything else he wanted. He felt like he was contributing. And he was, in his own way, he was contributing in such a beautiful way, but it was his attitude going into it, right?
Absolutely. In fact, I'll tell you another neat story. You know, a good friend of mine owns a chain of automobile dealerships around the Western United States, about 50 car dealerships, truck dealerships. And he came into my office one day. I've known him for 50 years. And he said, "You know, Hiram, there's the neatest feeling of the employees here at Franklin Covey." He said that, you know, the people just seem like they're on fire what they're doing. He says, "How do you do that?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that, but I think they've bought into the fact that what we do is we help people change lives all over the world." And he says, "You think your people all believe that?" And I said, "Well, I hope so, because that's what we do." And you know, and he said, "Well, when somebody asks you what you sell, what do you tell them?" And he was expecting me to say, well, we sell Franklin Day planners and time management seminars. And I said, no, what we sell is inner peace.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, inner peace? I said, yeah, you know, Black & Decker sells 340,000 quarter-inch drills every year. Nobody wants a quarter-inch drill. They want a quarter-inch hole. I said, you know, the hole we sell is inner peace. The drill is a Franklin Day planner. But I said, what people want is peace in their life. How do you get peace in your life? You bring what you do every day in line with your governing values. I mean, that's a time management seminar in 4 seconds.
Mm.
And that's all we teach, you know, and we charge big money for that. Anyway, so he said, would you mind if I walk around your company? I said, yeah, help yourself. So he gets out into our warehouse somehow. We got 200 people out there in this warehouse. And there's an old retired Air Force sergeant, 65 years old, sweeping the floor. And this guy's name is Bob Garth, dear friend. He walks up to this old guy and he says, what do you do here? And this old guy stopped his broom, leaned on his broom, looked at Bob Garf and said, I'm changing lives all over the world. And Bob Garf sprinted back to my office, man. He kicks my door open. You planted that bugger out there. I said, I don't even know where you've been. What are you talking about? And he tells me this story, and I thought, wow, how cool is that? You know, this old guy bought into the fact that his little contribution was helping us change lives all over the world. I mean, how cool is that?
Oh, so cool. So getting back to the your time management and the sort of, you were talking about your values and this idea of, you know, writing, you didn't call it a constitution, but what was the reference you used to it? Your own sort of declaration.
It's writing your own personal constitution. You know, you identify step one. You know, there are three steps. Let me just take you through the three steps of doing your constitution. Number one, you identify what the values are. Number two, you prioritize those values. And number three, you write a statement describing what those values mean to you, just like the founding fathers did with the Constitution. They didn't just say, we believe in the freedom of speech. They described what that meant. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
And so okay, what are my values? Well, one of my values is to be physically fit. Okay. How does that value rank against my faith in God? Well, that's downstream from my faith in God. And the reason you want to prioritize them is because, you know, there is such a possibility of a conflicting value. For example, if I value integrity and I also value loyalty, okay, which is more important to me, integrity or loyalty? And, you know, you go back to Watergate. You know, Nixon value most? You know, he valued loyalty, or his people valued loyalty to him rather than integrity. You know, when what's his name? The name not coming to me now. Burst into the Oval Office and said, hey, we got a problem at Watergate. And Nixon looked at him and said, fix it. I'm busy. Okay? So he went and fixed it. So loyalty to the president had more value to him than his own integrity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, if you put integrity above loyalty, it's going to change the decision you make when you're asked to do something that violates your integrity. So the prioritizing of the values is very important. So then the last thing, I'd write a paragraph. And once you've written the paragraph, you've got your personal constitution. And then every year we recommend that people revisit their constitution, because, you know, the priority may change, the paragraph describing what it means to you will definitely change as you grow. It'll grow, you know. And I look, you know, one of my governing values is to be a good father and husband. Well, you know, 30 years ago that meant X. Today it means a whole bunch of other stuff. I now have 6 children. We lost 1 child in a car accident, so I have 5 living children. I have 23 grandchildren. We lost 2 in the car accident, so I have 21 living grandkids. You want to hear my favorite poem?
Yeah, let's hear it.
I've seen the lights of Paris. I've seen the lights of Rome. My favorite lights are the taillights of the grandkids going home. Don't quote me on that. My wife will divorce me. But anyway, you know, so my feelings about what it means to be a good father and husband have grown and changed as I have grown and changed. And so this is not a stagnant document. This is a living, breathing document, just like the Constitution. You'll amend it. You'll improve it. You'll add value. It's rare that you drop a value, but you'll add them, you know, and your understanding of them will grow and change. You know, I recommend people do a family constitution. You know, we did it. We sat down as a family. This was 35 years ago. We sat down with our kids as they started to grow, and we said, well, what is our family constitution? What values do we have as a family? And so we wrote them down, and all the kids had to sign them, sign this constitution, okay? And I'll never forget my son, who was just here. He just left, but when he was a senior in high school, he's now 40 years old, but when he was a senior in high school, he comes to me and says, hey, Dad, you know, the prom is this coming Saturday night. Is it okay? You know, one of our things was you have to be home at midnight, okay? You know, the prom's coming up, you know, can I stay out till 2? I said, well, what does our constitution say? And he says, oh, crap. and he came home at midnight. I mean, it was very cool because, you know, he'd signed on to the family constitution. Mm. And I'll tell you, the impact that's had on my family is unbelievable. I mean, I don't say this in a bragging way at all, but I have 5 kids. You know, we lost the one. We have 5 living kids who are unbelievable. You know, they all did well in school. None of them ever had a drug problem. They've just been phenomenal kids. But, you know, when they're in their teens, they wrote their own constitutions. In fact, the daughter I lost in the car accident, she had written her own constitution, and we found it in her stuff about 3 weeks after she died. And it was a riveting experience for my wife and I to sit down and read this kid's constitution. I mean, she had it together. You know, she was an amazing kid.
I was going to ask you about that because we started the show talking about adaptability and control. And, you know, as you've talked about you losing your daughter and 2 grandchildren in a car accident. And I don't know, was her husband in the car as well?
No, he was not. In fact, I had another daughter that was in the car and she survived and she was on the phone with her husband when the car accident happened. And the girl that was driving that was killed was 3 weeks away from getting married. She was going to be married 3 weeks after the accident.
Mm. So my question is this, you know, things outside of our control, you know, so here's an accident in your family where, you know, obviously people closest to you you lose them. Talk about the adaptability, because you talk about them with such love and there's a joy in your voice, which is refreshing again, you know, again, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, you know, there are 2 things. Number one of the reasons, in fact, the biggest reason that I think my wife and I have been able to deal with the death of a daughter and 2 grandkids as we have, is that a big part of our faith is that this is not the end, that you know, our mortal experience is not the end, that we'll at some point be able to see that daughter and those grandkids again. And that faith, believing that, knowing that, really has had an unbelievable impact on our ability to deal with a really ugly experience. But I'll tell you, I learned this concept, and I'll tell you, if people listening to this thing today don't remember a thing I say, if they'll remember this one powerful concept that I discovered the week that my daughter was killed, and I, in fact, I wrote a book, and the title of the book is Pain is Inevitable, Misery is Optional.
Mm.
Pain is inevitable, misery is optional. And the fact is, we're not going to get through the mortal experience without some pain. How we choose to deal with that pain is ultimately a measure of who we are. And, you know, I shared this. I was asked to speak to the families of people affected by 9/11, 3-4 weeks after 9/11 in New York. Rudy Giuliani, I'd known him a long time, and anyway, long story short, asked me if I would do a workshop, me and Steve Covey, for the families affected by 9/11. I said, absolutely. And he said, I can't pay you, you know, but no, don't worry about that. We'll be there. So Steve and I flew into New York, and he arranged for a tour of Ground Zero at 5 o'clock that morning, and we went down, and I've spoken in the World Trade Center many, many times, stayed at the old Vista Hotel, then it became a Marriott. You've been there 100 times. And, you know, standing there on 15 feet of compacted debris and seeing that big hole in the ground was a really surreal experience. And anyway, then we came back to the hotel, and when I got up to speak, in this ballroom, there's 2,500 people in a ballroom designed for 2,000, so people are sitting on the floor. And when I got up to speak, before I could open my mouth, a fireman about halfway back in the audience in a dress blue uniform jumped out of his seat, shouted at me and said, "Mr. Smith, are you going to tell us how we get out of bed in the morning when we just don't give a crap anymore?" That's how it started. This turned out to be one of the toughest and maybe most rewarding experiences speaking I've ever had. And so I said to this fireman, I said, "I'm going to say something." And I said, "If you remember a thing I say, you remember this." I said, "Pain is inevitable. Misery is optional." And I said, "You're not going to get through the mortal experience without some pain. We've all experienced some pain here." And I said, "I will tell you that some of the most serene, magnificent, unbelievably powerful people I have ever met are people that have had to deal with excruciating pain. There are lots of different kinds of pain. There's spiritual pain, physical pain, psychological pain, emotional pain. There's all kinds of pain. But I said, how we choose to deal with that pain, we are going to decide." And then I said to them, I said, "You know, I'm not going to minimize what happened here on 9/11. This was a bad deal. But I said, if you'll go back over the last 150 years and compare what happened here on 9/11 to what's happened on this planet in the last 150 years, what happened here in 9/11 doesn't even come up on the scope of ugliness in comparison."
Mm.
And I mean, you could hear a pin drop, man. And I said, "Come on, let's go back to June 6, 1944. Now let's go back to June 5th, 1944. Eisenhower's in a bunker in England. He said to his generals, "You know, we've got to throw more kids at that beach tomorrow than they have bullets in the bunker." So what'd they do the next day? They threw 200,000 kids at that beach. And you know what happened? They ran out of bullets in the bunker. And Eisenhower estimated within 300 kids how many he'd lose because he'd estimated the bullets in the bunkers. He said, "How often do we reverence that? You know, Battle of Iwo Jima, 8,000 dead Marines, 20,000 dead Japanese soldiers. How often do we reverence that?" And it was really a very powerful experience. And the fact is, that's had an impact on my life, because every time you start thinking about, man, you know, the world's against me and I got all this crap, I lost my 401k, or I just got divorced, or, you know, I've had a kid in an accident, and, you know, how bad life is. Fact is, we still are alive. We can still breathe. We can still put one foot in front of the other, and we can decide.
You can still adapt.
Absolutely. We can adapt. Absolutely.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's so interesting about what you said, because I had so many images coming up, you know. I mean, standing in the Holocaust Museum in Tel Aviv. Yeah, I'm not Jewish, I remember weeping and weeping. I mean, just crying. And I was a young guy, you know. I wasn't doing this kind of work was not even on my radar. This is in 1984. And I just remember bawling at the absolute unbelievableness of 6 million people being, you know, annihilated. I couldn't fathom it, you know.
Yeah.
But I do find, and we lost a young family member, an 11-year-old girl in our family, and I've lost a 50-year-old brother, and it's true what you're saying, and what I love about your adaptability and your joy, like I say, is that this concept. I thought we were going to talk about one thing. Again, I told you I have no expectations where the conversation is going to go, but this one philosophy could change every single person's life when they realize when they're in it, whether it's an embezzlement, it's a death, whether
absolutely.
I think about that, you know, whether you lose your back tomorrow. How many times have we seen somebody who's become a paraplegic or a quadriplegic who went on to do magnificent things in the world because of the situation that occurs, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, Charles Krauthammer is a great example. I just read Charles Krauthammer. You know who he is? He's a Fox News guy.
No, I don't know him.
He's a writer, and unbelievable writer, and he's a paraplegic. He dived in a pool and hit his neck when he was 18 or something, and been in a wheelchair his entire life, and he's one of the most amazing political writers, thinkers I've ever seen. But that's a classic example of a guy that turned adversity into an unbelievable, productive, meaningful, contributory life, you know?
Yeah, it was
I gotta tell you a really cool story, just really fast. When I was in Israel last time, I was a guest of the consulate general from Los Angeles, and they gave us a tour of an Air Force base just south of Tel Aviv. And this major told us a story, and this is not a well-known story, but you're going to love this story. The Israeli Air Force, ever since 1947, wanted to fly their jets over Auschwitz, just as kind of a in-your-face, you know, nobody's going to screw with us anymore. And, the Polish government would never give them permission. Well, about 5 years ago, the Polish government finally decided, all right, we'll let you fly your F-16s over Auschwitz, but you got to do it at 30,000 feet, okay? And so they got all excited about this, and they picked three pilots, three F-16s. They had to refuel twice between Israel and Poland to get there because nobody let them land. And they had 300 Israeli soldiers on the ground at Auschwitz for this flyover. And when these three pilots got within 100 miles of Auschwitz, the lead pilot radioed his two wingmen and he said, you know what, guys? Screw this 30,000 feet stuff. We're going down on the deck. They flew down and they went over Auschwitz at 300 feet and just roared over Auschwitz. And the 300 Israeli soldiers went freaking nuts, you know? And I tell you, what that meant to Israel, you cannot imagine. And the guy who's in the lead jet is now the four-star general over the Israeli Air Force.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, you know, I actually did a show earlier today, and I've got to tell you, this time has gone. We're already way over time, and
I apologize.
No. I want to bring you back on sooner rather than later, and continue this conversation because I feel like we haven't even rubbed the surface, let alone scratched the surface yet. So, Hiram, I just want to thank you so much for being on the show, and I want to ask you. There's two things I want to ask you before we go. First off, the show is called The Kick-Ass Life. And I wonder if you had to describe what a kick-ass life is for you, Hiram W. Smith. How do you describe a kick-ass life?
A kick-ass life for me is bringing the events of my life in line with what matters most to me. Because when I do that, when I close the gap between what I do and what I value, I experience an unbelievable sense of inner peace. So that's kick-ass for me. And if I value being physically fit, then I'm going to stay under 190 pounds. If I value being financially okay, I'm not going to be in debt. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And the last thing is, there any last parting words, wisdoms that you'd like to share before we call this a wrap?
You know, I just remember that statement. Pain is inevitable. Misery is optional. And if you get that deep down in your core, then you'll be able to deal with whatever the world throws at you. You'll be able to adapt to it.
Well, I may be stealing that and writing a program around it. I can see a 4 or 5 day program that says, Tyler, is such a powerful concept. So, Hiram, I look forward to our continued relationship. I really am glad that we stepped into each other's lives, and I look forward to that.
Great.
And remember, the bed's made.
By the way, I just wrote a book called The Power of Perception that people can see on my website. It's kind of a fun book.
Well, actually, HiramWSmith.com is where people want to go if they want to come play with you. And truly, again, we sort of rubbed the surface on what's of what you do. But really, I mean, 50 years of your work and truly life-changing work. So HiramSmith.com, come along and play with Hiram. It truly is a wonderful experience. And again, I look forward to it too.
Yeah, let's do it again. I'd love to do it.
Okay, ciao.
All right, take care.
Pretty cool, eh? To write your own personal constitution. I like that. That's awesome. And Lao Tzu says, time is a created thing. To say I don't have time is like saying I don't want to. That's so great. I really so enjoyed his wonderful style, and I really look forward to a continued relationship. When you hear me say on a show, hey, the bed's made, I mean it. I'm not one of these guys that says those things without it absolutely coming from the heart. So I look forward to that. And I look forward to going down there after the show. He says, hey, get your butt down here and we'll enjoy the ranch. So I look forward to that. And you remember this sort of saying that time is a game played beautifully by children. And I think, you know, as we grow older, we often forget the wonders of time. And as I was talking about, you know, with my country and Western saloon days, when I first started, I was not a country fan at all. But by the end, you know, I learned to two-step, and we had this just a great, great, great experience for the year, because I sold the restaurant after a year. I just didn't want to do it all over again. But in a small town where we became sort of the epicenter of everything, we threw so many great events throughout the year. In Valentine's, we had limousines picking up all of our guests, and our waiters were in white tuxedos, and we had a little small bottle of champagne in the back of the car and a rose, and you know, Julio Iglesias playing on the through our sound system. People still talk. I mean, that's, I don't know how many years ago that is, 15 years ago or so. People still talk about that being memorable when I'm in town, when I go back to High River, Alberta. But the love affair I sort of started with country music, and at the time, this great gentleman was truly sort of a living legend. But I found country music to be quite interesting. Was the when you go to a country and western bar, and you know, it's not about looks as much anymore. If you're a great dancer, you can dance with anyone you want, man or woman. It doesn't matter how big you are or small you are, if you have hair, no teeth. If you're a great dancer, people love to dance. And that was the thing that I really was refreshing, was to go to a bar where, you know, when the music came on, and we used to have a live band every single weekend, and some great bands too, you know, and watching the whole dance floor fill up. And when the dance floor was full, people would be dancing around the tables. But it was always a wonderful experience. And it certainly was one of those pinnacle times in my life where I look at a new experience that I stepped into. And again, not that I would ever own a restaurant. Again, there's a great saying, if you want to make $1 million in the restaurant business, start with 2 million. Although we did really, really well, it's just food and beverage is a very, very tough thing. And I always promised I'd never get back into it. And then I go and buy an island. Well, how crazy am I? But here's another tribute to the wonderful Hiram W. Smith. And hopefully you'll enjoy this song.
Looking back on the memory of the dance we shared beneath the stars above. For a moment, all the world was right. And how could I have known that you'd ever say goodbye? And now, I'm glad I didn't know the way it all would end, the way it all would go. Our lives are better left to chance. I could have missed the pain, but I'd have had to miss the
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Time to dance. As always, always, always time to dance. And I want to thank you for listening in. And don't forget, if you didn't catch the Ask Dave and Jen show on Saturday, there were some amazing questions. And I always love the challenge of going into the Q&A and just sort of trusting my heart and my experience to be able to answer the questions in the way I know how. And don't forget, we have Thursday show coming up where I ride solo, bring my own experience and my trainings to you. And of course, Monday, which was yesterday, a 10-minute show, a little kick in the bum, get you going for the week. Have a little bit of fun, and hopefully you enjoy the shows. And I really, really appreciate you coming along. And Hiram, you're a gentleman, a scholar, and an inspiration. So we'll definitely see you on the other side.
That was kick-ass.